You're listening to Read Between the Letting with Aaron Heath
and Matt McInerney.
It's April 9th, 2009. Tonight we have Stephen Coles of Font Shop and of his own Typographica on the show.
We'll be talking a bit about Stephen, as well as typographic diversity, selling your type, and why Stephen believes this is the golden age of typography.
No need to justify listening to this one, folks. Stay tuned. All right, Stephen Coles is on the show today. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on. We're going to start just by just asking you a few questions about, I guess, your history as a designer in the design field. If you could talk to us a little bit about that and how you got involved with Font Shop and pretty much the history of Typographica.
Okay, thank you for inviting me. I got into type, I think, when I got my first Mac, which was a Mac 512K. So that was probably, I don't know if it's the second or the third model that came out, and there really wasn't that much to do then on a Mac, I guess if you compare it to what's going on now. So, but one of the things that they touted and they had that other computers didn't was a broad range of fonts, and so I got into that pretty early because of those Susan Kare designed fonts that were on there. All those early bitmap ones using my dot matrix printer and all that. And somehow, it was always, I think it may be because I was a bird watcher initially that I got into identifying fonts as well. So something about seeing things out in the wild and putting them in a class and giving them a name, they somehow come together. So those two things collided, and then in college I worked at a newspaper, the college paper in the University of Utah, and did the page layout and was very interested in what typefaces we chose and the layout, how that all affected readability, because it was something that even in graphic design school they didn't talk enough about, I thought. So that was kind of my entrance into the type world, and then that's when I hooked up with Joshua Louis Terrell, who had started Typographica as a blog. The second type blog, or the third type blog, probably, there was typographer.org, David John Earle's thing, and then there was Lines and Splines, which was, I know you guys are probably too young to know it.
Yeah,
I think we actually are.
it's a bit of a legend among, I guess, anybody over 30. But it was the only thing around for a long time, and it was just a single author, and Andrew Crudson,
and he was this a magazine or
no? This was another blog. This was the only other blog that was out there on type.
What year was this?
Let's see. This would be 2001, 2000.
Okay. Yeah.
And because Typographica started in 2002, shortly after that. But it was just, he was very good at just making keen observations about typography and new type and trends and things like that. A very academic fellow. He was a historian, like a history major at Berkeley. And so people really relied on his blog for not so much the news stuff, but more of academic discussion about type. And so Typographica came along as more of a discussion because there was multiple authors. So we invited type designers and typographers to all come and just post whatever the hell they wanted, and they did. And it was pretty rowdy and strange and unorganized for the first few years. But it worked well that way because there was not that many places to discuss type specifically. So that's how Typographica got started. And I was using that as a platform, really, to just complain about type sellers and foundries and what they should be doing better or what was great. You know, I just spouting my opinion off as bloggers do.
Did you find that it influenced? Did it influence any of them?
Well,
did you ever get contacted?
I didn't think so until I got a call from Font Shop, and I was working in Sweden at the time with a type designer, Stefan Hottenbach. And I was just writing the blog on, you know, spouting my drivel as usual. And one day I got a call from Font Shop, and they they said, "Why don't you, since you're in Stockholm, why don't you come down to Berlin and just talk to us for a while?" And I came down, and they said, "Well, we've been reading these things. You obviously have some ideas, so here's where we are." You know, they were a little bit later to the game getting online, and so they wanted to make sure that they were up to speed. And I had always complained about how they have this great heritage, you know, founded by Eric Spiekerman and Neville Brody, all these great fonts. The Font Library is one of the best collections, foundries, and yet their online presence was so weak. And so
So they brought you in to basically do that.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a one-day little consultation thing, and I said, "Oh, that's really nice of them to fly me down." And I felt like way out of my league, but apparently I had enough ideas that they said, "Why don't you come to San Francisco and work in our office there?" So that's how I got into the industry, like blogger gone pro.
What were some of your big ideas besides getting them online that they wanted to keep you on board?
It was really just. It was the whole online presence. Like, a lot of what I do now is just make sure that the brand and the voice of FontShop is getting out there to all the different online outlets, whether it's forums or social networking. They felt like they were aging when really they are a young, hip company, but their online presence wasn't there. So. A lot of it was that, and then the way that fonts are displayed, I spend a lot of my days just thinking and trying new things with how we display hundreds of thousands of fonts and make sure that the good stuff rises to the top and how people use the online sampler to, you know, hopefully they get as much out of that as they can.
I would say that's worked out pretty well. I mean, since Matt and I are kind of new to all of this in a relative way, Matt FontShop, I would say it's pretty hip. I definitely enjoy the ads. I definitely know about it. I don't at this point. I wouldn't say that it's aging anymore.
Well, oh, absolutely not.
That's kind of you.
Yeah,
but I mean, and I'm assuming you're the guy that made that FontFeed happen too.
Oh, it was Eric Spiekerman's idea. He said we have the best writers in the business. With Jürgen Siebert is FontShop Germany. He does their marketing and their writing, and then Yves Peters in Belgium has been doing a lot of writing for us as well. And I had authored the blog that when it was on FontShop, and so he said, why don't you bring everybody together and under one roof and one website. And because Typographica actually had been so quiet for so long, there was a bit of a hole there, and it's become a really good outlet for news.
So you
and
almost,
what's going on in the type world.
You almost became one of your own competitors in Typographica.
I could say that in a way. Yeah, it's tough when you're working all day on fonts and talking about fonts with people all day.
That's true.
And then you go home. It's kind of hard to have a hobby in which is, you're doing
job.
The same stuff as your job. Yeah.
I wanted to jump back for a second and talking about your history a little bit. You said something about bird watching and going out and classifying typefaces. Is that something that you did before you really knew much about type? When you were very young, before you knew much about graphic design or what you were doing, did you kind of subconsciously go out and look around you at typography a lot and classify it in your head?
Oh, yeah. I mean... There was a limited range of fonts on the Mac, but then I had an AOL account, and I would go and download every free font that came up on AOL. And say, and how am I going to put this on my hard drive in a logical manner? And so, my file folder system became my own kind of amateur way of classifying type. And yeah, I do. I feel like that's just kind of part of my personality. I like things to put things in their buckets so that they can easily be retrieved later.
Is walking down the street and seeing millions of different typefaces and having to classify them, is that a joy or is that a bit of a hell?
Oh, it's a joy for me. It's a hell for anybody near me.
Yeah.
And has that changed a lot since, I mean, you're talking about getting on AOL to do it. In the past 10 or 15 years, with the rise of available faces, do you feel like your visual landscape, you know, the bird watching has changed from this kind of like, oh, here's like 20 typefaces I see kind of commonly, to what in the world is going on around me now?
Yeah. Well, it's really exciting. I mean, it kind of bleeds into what I wanted to talk about as far as typography becoming more democratized and being more, type design being more available to people, and the way they distribute it being more available. Even the number of free fonts that are, the quality of free fonts has increased exponentially in the last year. So you see this really sharp upturn in the number of people who are doing serious type design, and the number of ways that you can get access to it and view it, and people are becoming more educated, and it's...
Yeah, and I would say the number of people who appreciate the good type design.
Right. And I think it's because of... I was talking to somebody about how this kind of happened in the music industry lately. It used to be kind of force-fed your music through MTV or radio, and obviously because of the internet, you have access to all the stuff you wouldn't have known about otherwise. And it's the same thing in the type world now. You don't have to be with a large foundry to get known. And then the people who are using type, they don't have to only get, you know, what the Adobe catalog like they used to, or even the Font Shop catalog to know what's new and what's interesting. They can get it all for free, and all really, it's all very accessible. And that just kind of snowballs, because as other type designers see that stuff, then they learn more, and the whole thing explodes into
an
awareness. That's why I think it's a really exciting time to be. I mean, iMagazine's current issue is all about that. How it, you know, some say it is the golden age of typography, because you have this explosion of new ideas, and the number of people who are designing things and understanding typography is much larger than it ever has been.
You know, go ahead, Matt.
I was gonna say I'm continually blown away at how well independent foundries are doing, or just independent type designers are doing, putting their own stuff out, and the quality of work. We recently had Mark Simonson on the show.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite designers.
Yeah, and I am kind of blown away at how successful he's been able to do by just releasing his stuff to resellers and having his own independent foundry, and the amount of work he's able to do.
And another one, you know, we hear about this all the time, but kind of the little rock star of releasing free faces right now is Museo, and how well that's done. And the thing that I think is really interesting about that is, even in the past 3 months, I hear more and more about just normal people don't know much about it. They might not be interested in graphic design per se or typography, but they are realizing the difference between using something they found on their PC and going out and finding some of these higher quality but still free faces. You know, I hear people talking about Museo that aren't in the design world, which I think it's kind of like the, I guess, the MySpace culture, the do-it-yourself culture is bleeding over a little bit, but finally we're seeing a little bit of quality with that as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, design in general, whether it's graphic design or furniture design or the whole IKEA culture, I think that's all has a positive effect on people's aesthetic value and actually paying attention to what good design is. Quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Recently. And this is kind of bled over into about, it's teetering on three of our topics, actually. So we'll go ahead. You already started to allude to the golden age of typography and saying that basically you think this is the golden age of typography because of the accessibility?
Yeah. And I think it's, the internet has a great deal to do with that. And also the opportunity for independent type designers to make a living, so you're not going through major publishers to get something out there, that just makes an explosion of new type design.
I guess that is really prominent with the internet, because like you said, the music industry is going through something a lot like that. It's kind of like the the 21st century version of what happened in the 50s. You know, we have this, I feel like that's happening in a lot of different industries now, when people have the ability to take things and do things themselves and set up their own small businesses, things really start to take off, it seems like.
Hmm. Well, what it seems to be is the internet's the new middleman. It's not, like, for music, the example, the record label was the middleman. Now iTunes is the middleman. Now you can just have a small e-commerce store, and you can sell. Yeah, I mean, you could sell your own fonts on Big Cartel or something, like some really small e-commerce site. Mm. And yeah, I mean, granted, you have to do your own customer service and stuff. You have to kind of be a jack of all trades, but you can do it.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and jump into this one topic then, about marketing yourself. This article on Typographica, actually, taking your fonts to market, foundry reseller or going solo.
I guess, well, one of the things along these lines I was interested in is, Stephen, what do you think about the balance between people being able to get free fonts and then being on the other side of having to sell your fonts and having to compete in that kind of market?
Well, it's perfect timing, because the third top story on Dig today was a collection of free fonts.
Oh, we were talking about that earlier.
Professional designers. Yeah. I have mixed feelings, because I'm in the industry, and so I feel protective a lot of the times. I'll be honest about that, and I'll see that, and I'll immediately have this negative reaction to it. I'm like, it can't be any good.
I think I do that to top 50 lists in general when it comes to that.
Sure.
I always am like, what's going to, you know, after number two, what are they going to show?
Yeah, and you just feel like they're just catching on to some trend, and, you know, link bait trend, where they realize that if they do a list that they're going to get a lot of traffic. But I see the list, and it's fairly, most of the stuff on there is fairly well designed. It's very serious type design. But then you start to realize, well, what really would you be getting with any of these families? And most of them aren't families. They're single fonts in mostly display typography. If there is a sans or serif, most of those are not families that are available for free. And, you know, type designers or people who get involved with type design realize as they're doing it, if they're going to do it at that level, they're not going to publish for an entire family for free because of the amount of work that is involved. So it really does work itself out, and I think it's actually a positive thing. You have people that are, you know, seeing that stuff, and they realize what good type design is, and then once they really want to do something, you know, publish a magazine or do some professional design, then they realize, well, maybe I do need some more weights. I need a bold and italic, or I need multiple widths for design type or display typography. So it's a good way to introduce people. I don't think it's an all negative.
Yeah. Well, I guess on the negative side, though, do you think that a lot of the negative reaction you might have towards it is because when people have all these free fonts available to them, it starts to feel like it's an entitlement that fonts should be free?
Sure, yeah. That always concerns me, devaluation of fonts. And I don't really, I think that it's all kind of gut reaction. I don't think there's enough evidence either way. And I think it's something that's always been a problem ever since we used personal computers. People kind of thought fonts should be free because they came with the computer.
It happens with a lot of things, and not just typography in general, but it's kind of like you were saying, Stephen, about how it's like a stepping stone, really, and as they get these or look at these free faces and use them a bit, it might make them become more interested in typography and discover what they're really looking for in a higher quality typeface, and then be willing to pay for it. And this is something that Ellen Lupton kind of argues a lot in design with her do-it-yourself books, basically that... she was basically saying how some designers worry about how easy it's becoming for other people to do design work now with the accessibility of Photoshop and things like that. Mm-hmm. And she was arguing that it's not bad at all, because they're producing work which still is better than nothing out there. You know, it's still better than someone setting something in Word. Mm-hmm. And the people who actually want professional design work are still going to come to professional designers. You know, they're not going to just rely on a family friend to do it.
Sure.
And really all it does is it increases the visual landscape, in quality for everyone, even if it's just by a little bit. And I you know, in some ways, I guess the typography is a lot the same. If we, even though some of these free faces, like Matt and I, one of the things on that list was Alta Haas Grotesque, that Matt and I have we both have a real problem with. Mm-hmm. Mostly have because the description is the face, the font looks like a, it says a yeah, Joseph Muller Brockman like book that was printed, mm-hmm. and it doesn't reference Helvetica or Accidents Grotesque. It references the fact that if you print a book that Brockman made, this is what it would look like if you scan it back in.
Yeah, well, it's funny. He's taken a trip back to the late 80s then, because that's what everyone did in the grunge era. So it's kind of he's kind of a little behind on that.
I think, and one of the reasons we kind of have a prejudice is that we've seen design work in our own classes where students who, rather than going through the fonts that are, you know, obviously our school purchases a lot of fonts that are professional and would be great to use, and rather than looking at like Helvetica or Univer or a font that is a pro version of that, they just go to DeFont and they download Alta Haas and they put it in, and then the professor goes, "What?
Mm-hmm. Why do you like this?"
Well, no, I think a good point to be made about the democratization of these tools is you need to know the difference, that there is a difference between the tool and the designer who has talent and training.
Right.
Because you can't do amazing design just by having Photoshop, and we know that. And it's the same thing with typefaces and Paula Scher did this these templates for HP a while back.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And there was a little bit of uproar in the design community saying, "Well, why are you making us obsolete? You know, you're making it so anybody can do stuff." And she said, "Well, if you think these are better than what you can do, then you probably shouldn't be a designer, because this is just, it's stepping it up, an extra step. But it's not, it's not a professional custom design that they could get from you if you're a good designer."
Exactly. And that's pretty much what Lupton was saying. All this is doing is increasing the visual world around us. You know, we don't have to look at some of these uglier things more often, but people are still going to need custom solutions, custom design, you know, personal design work. So it's like you said, it's kind of a gut reaction right now, this cringe that we have to some things. But I think everything balances out ultimately.
It's funny, there's actually another piece of that Paula Scher story that relates to what we're talking about with the entitlement to fonts should be free, or like preventing piracy in fonts. And that she approached Jonathan Heffler initially to talk about adding Gotham to that family of fonts. Mm. And
I'm sure he wasn't pleased with that idea.
Yeah, and he said no because of the possibility that people could pirate the font, which is an interesting way to approaching design, in that not making the decision based on the best possible typeface for the context, but the possible negative monetary value that you could.
Yeah,
deal to a foundry.
I think. That could be a whole other, discussion.
But conversation.
There's a problem that foundries and type makers have in being a little protectionist about their products. But
I kind of feel like I've noticed it from type foundries more than other areas of graphic design, especially. There does seem to be this hesitance, especially, and this kind of leads us into another conversation. Type on the web. We've talked a little bit about this before, but I definitely want to go into it again, and I know Matt does too, with the whole CIFR and all these technologies coming for the web, and mm-hmm. and how type is transitioning to the web. And I think this is one thing that where foundries are really showing their worries,
yeah.
if you will.
Yeah. Well, actually, I have to give Heffler credit on this one, because he was one of the first to specifically identify CIFR in his license agreement and make it really clear that you can use it as long as you put certain security restrictions in there. And so that was good.
I've seen some beautiful work with stuff like Archer on the web. With
sure.
People
oh, yeah.
Yeah, who've just bought a legitimate copy and put it on their server and use CIFR as a solution to, you know, having to use Arial or Georgia on your website.
Right, and CIFR is something that most foundries are open to. It's just when you get to the at font face designation that there's a problem you're downloading the actual font file.
And, right. Is this a discussion within the type world right now? I know it is within the graphic design world.
I don't know
if
discussion's the right word. It's more of a...
Do you think foundries are looking for a solution?
Without a doubt. I mean, I actually wrote about this on Typographica too. I'm glad that you brought up two things I've written about in the last year, because that's about all I've written in the last year. But it's an industry that is very fragmented. A lot of these foundries are one or two people. The big ones are often owned by companies who don't really understand type design. They're just holding companies, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so there isn't there are organizations like A-Type-I that do conferences, but as far as an organization that actually brings everybody together and says what is going to be the right response for the common good of all these foundries, that just doesn't exist. So each foundry is kind of trying to come up with their own idea. Nobody really has the resources to come up with a technology that's going to compete with @FontFace, because no one likes that. So it's really tough for them to all come together. I mean, I can understand graphic designers saying, why can't these font foundries get it together and catch up with the time? But, you know, coming from the inside, I understand how difficult it is for them to, not that they're just protecting fonts from being spread, but giving an alternative technology so that they, not DRM, but so that it's protecting even the user's computer, right. So that you're not downloading fonts. Eric Van Vlokland, who is an expert in the whole font technology field, he explained how you could actually crash every visitor's computer that visits your website just by having a font load, because it could download, it loads into your system. If you have a corrupt font, it can wreak havoc on your system. So there are all sorts of little problems that come with this, and it's just a matter of coming up with an alternative that's better.
Do you think we're going to see an alternative come from a font foundry, or do you think it's probably going to come from a party like an Apple who's developing WebKit, or like a Mozilla or something like that?
Or W3.
I don't feel qualified to answer. I mean, I think it's there's just not enough. There aren't enough resources in the foundry world, but then there's not enough interest in Apple to do something that's going to protect font foundries. So it's neither side really has what it takes to get it done. Microsoft has actually been more of a champion for the foundries than anyone.
Well, they were working with OpenType, the OpenType spec a lot before, weren't they?
Yes.
Them and Adobe.
Right. And, yeah, actually their typography division is the only thing that about Microsoft that I think is redeemable. I mean, they've done amazing stuff. I mean, they developed Georgia and Verdana with Matthew Carter.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
And then they have this EOT format, which is the one alternative that some foundries are okay with, because it's possible to, add some more security to it, tie it to certain domains and things like that. So that's one option, but I really don't know how it's going to shake out.
It's kind of interesting, because this is something that we come back to on the show, Matt and I do a lot, is the idea of coming together in collaboration to setting standards in the graphic design community, at least. And it sounds like just a very similar thing with the typography or the type foundry community as well, is that there's not necessarily these built up levels of communication because of, in some ways, the youth of the industry. But it's just something, I guess, that hopefully we'll see more of in the future, or maybe this is something that does need to be talked about more, and kind of getting these summits organized for these kinds of questions.
Yeah, we hosted a panel at the last TypeCon about this topic, and we had both font users and font makers on the panel, and we had a lot of discussion about it. But maybe it's just too early, it's not been around long enough, but nobody has any other solutions right now. And as far as like too early for technology, like OpenType has been around for 10 years almost, and it's still slowly, people are slowly realizing that's what they should be, using.
And why is that?
Well, there are a couple of problems. One is that it costs more from most foundries. They put more into their OpenType fonts, and so if you're a young designer or a designer on a budget, you're often going to go with what's least expensive. You can get, say, I can get Meta, or I can get Meta OT. They have the same character shapes, it seems to me, as a novice font user. So why would I get the one that costs $10 more? So there's the price is an issue. They don't realize they're getting a lot more right up front, and you know, everybody's got to do a better job of making it understandable that OpenType is much better for designers, but also support and applications has been pretty lame.
Slow.
And here's where Microsoft, I can complain about them, because Office is something that it doesn't know OpenType exists except for language, you know, support. So sure. when you're selling OpenType to a big company, say they buy a big user license for their whole company, people who are just using it in Word, they're not going to have access to the small caps, because those are, you know, that part of the character set is only accessible to an OpenType savvy application like Illustrator or InDesign. So if you don't have the proper support in all the graphic design or the Office apps, then you know, OpenType can never succeed.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk about kind of the flip side of what we're talking about with so many fonts on the web. The opposite of that is the way graphic designers latch on to just a few faces, and they are very reluctant to get away from a few of their favorites.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I think a really famous example we've seen is in the documentary Helvetica. We hear about Massimo Vignelli talking about how there are maybe five good font typefaces in the world, maybe. And I think a lot of graphic designers hear that and they adopt the attitude.
He's everybody's favorite design fascist. I love him,
so
but
Steven,
yeah, I don't agree with him either.
Yeah. So what do you think of that, and what do you think of that attitude for font founders in general, or just for the general typographic landscape?
Well, I am obviously biased because I sell fonts, and so yeah. I'm going to give you an answer that I'd like people to buy different fonts, but this has always been my view. I'm like, I don't want to see the same coffee shop on every corner, and I don't want to see the same store on every corner, so why would I want to see the same typeface everywhere? And I think that this is mostly a problem with fonts that are bundled with system software, and that's my biggest complaint. But as people using the same font over and over again, then you lose like the culture in the individual place. So you go to, you know, somewhere in Europe, you expect to see, you know, a different kind of design culture, and you do to an extent with things that are properly designed, but as people use the same font over and over again, then everything just becomes homogenous and dull and ugly.
Yeah.
And
the pirate scenario and
yes, times. Yes, yes. And this even happens with good fonts. I mean, some of these are really good. Like Frutiger is an excellent signage font, but it's becoming kind of the default signage font for all airports. So as you go from airport to airport around the country or even around the world, it's almost like you're seeing the same signs everywhere, and it's really disappointing. I mean, this recently happened in London. At London Heathrow had their own custom serif design, and it was very English. And then they just switched over to Frutiger, and the last time I went there, I was just so disappointed, and I felt like, oh, I could be anywhere right now. I wouldn't even know.
I'd agree with that, but. Well, to play devil's advocate for something like airport signage, is that appropriate in a way that everyone is kind of standardizing? You know, so if you're traveling, you do have this sort of visual idea of what to expect, and does that help?
Oh, you can read an A from, you know, 1,500 different typefaces. I don't think that's. Yeah, I mean, I do think there's a point to be made for standardization, and I think that more comes in the way. That things are laid out and not necessarily the style of iconography, but what kind of, you know, what icon means what, and that's already worked itself out. You know, you have certain icons mean restroom, but they can be stylized differently.
Well, I'll pitch another idea, and this has nothing to do with graphic designers having a certain style or believing a certain thing. How about the idea that because we have so many fonts right now and we have so many typefaces that are available, it becomes kind of overwhelming. So you see graphic designers latching onto a few that they feel really comfortable with, and then they don't want to break outside that box.
Yeah, yeah. No, actually, this is a great segue again to Typographica, because we're redesigning it, and it's supposed to be done right now, but as you do things on your own without a client, you tend to keep tweaking and tweaking until you never stop.
But yes.
I'm redesigning it, and so that it's going to be more centered on type reviews, typeface reviews, because that is a problem. There's so much out there, and it's difficult to know just by looking at something online if it's of good quality. I mean, how well is this going to print? Can you trust it to be good enough for your client? And you know, PDFs help a lot with that. You print things out, and people's, you know, the respect of the foundry that you might have, that helps. But I want to get more typeface reviews out there so that people kind of had an educated decision that they can be making.
That would be a really good resource.
Yeah, I'm hoping that people feel the same way, because that's you know, there are so many great type blogs out there right now that I can't really compete with that anymore, and I feel like this is something that is kind of a hole, you know, there's a need for this. So I'm hoping that that's going to be useful. There is so much good stuff, and there's so much bad stuff, and some of it is copies of other things that are better, and it's hard to get a handle on all of it when, you know, you have 300 fonts being released in a month, and
And is this something you're willing to do, is review the bad as well and say, well, this isn't really
yes.
that great?
Oh yeah, I mean, we'll invite people to review whatever they like, and you know, if I trust their judgment, and then we'll put it up there. And I think that's it has to happen, because there's no resource for it right now. There's nowhere that somebody can say this font is a copy of something that already exists. It's doing it the same thing but doing it poorly. So yeah. You shouldn't buy it. It's half the cost, but it's not going to be good for you in the long run.
My wish list is some sort of feature that also pairs typefaces, and it says if things that would look nice paired with this typeface in some sort of document, or here are a few other faces.
Yeah, that's
I'd love to see that.
That is a question I get more than almost any other at FontShop, like from customers. Like, I've got this, what should I use with it?
I keep referencing this lower and uppercase magazine from, you know, a while back, and they had an article on it with maybe like 20 faces, and it was one of the best resources I feel like I've ever seen, and it would be so much better if we could extend it to today and with all the faces we have.
Yeah, it's kind of a it's definitely worth doing. I'm kind of overwhelmed by it, because I feel like every one typeface, every text face has, you know, 1,000 other faces that will work with it. And so often when people ask me that, I say, well, let's first talk about what your project is. What are you working on? Find the typefaces that match or that suit your subject matter and your audience first. And then that helps narrow it down to, you know, the stuff that will work well together. But I think it's usually asking the wrong question, you know, first, if you're buying them for a specific project. If you're getting it just for you're getting a tool set of fonts that you're going to use for lots of different projects, then it makes sense that way. But if you're trying to buy it, you know, you're designing a magazine and you have your text face and you're like, what's going to work well with this? Well, first you should ask, you know, what is your magazine's voice? Who is its audience?
Exactly.
You make a stylistic decision first.
That kind of transitioned to one of our reader questions as well, one of our listeners' questions. I don't have that one written down, but it's answered now. So we'll start off with something else. Let's see. Mr. Alex Weber asks, where do you see yourself in 5 years, Stephen? I guess this includes Typographica and things like that.
Wow. I don't even know what I'm doing tomorrow. You know, I feel very lucky. I'm doing pretty much what I want to do. So, you know, as I think if I saw myself in 5 years doing the same thing, only better, then I would be happy.
All right.
Yeah, another question we got, and this is referencing your Mid-Century Modern blog.
Another plug.
Yeah. Jerry Matthews asks, which typeface is the most Mid-Century Modern furniture? Or is the most like mid-century modern furniture?
This is a friend of mine. He's trying to stump me.
Okay.
Well, actually, a friend of mine, Carl Crossgrove, he works for Monotype, and he design something that he was actually trying to do this because he had never, you know, he's a fan of the mid-century modern aesthetic, and he's like, there isn't really a typeface that kind of gives you that feeling. And he tried to design one, and it ended up being something kind of different. So I think what he found is that it's just not possible. If I was going to say something that you would use that works, you would use something that they used in that era. So, you know, there's a typeface called 20th Century, which is kind of the American version of Futura. That was used a lot in the U.S. in the 50s and 60s. And then there's, you know, a lot of Gothics, Grotesques, those things.
I was like, that reminds me of I took a book out from the library recently on Mies van der Rohe, and the entire thing was impossible to read because they tried to set it in Euro style.
Oh, Euro style! That, I should have brought that up. That's the perfect mid-century face, actually. More of the space age aesthetic of it, but yeah.
I can't believe they would try. Definitely trying to mimic, you know, that era, but by doing so, it made it completely illegible.
That's awful.
Like, it was, it's very hard to read Euro style as text.
Yeah,
which is the perfect example of choosing a face for the purpose of the project and not just because you like the aesthetic quality or it goes with the, you know, choosing a face for its function as well, or at least keeping that in mind as an option for reasoning.
Yeah, no, definitely you have to keep that in mind. And it does work as a display face for that era because Euro style was used quite a bit in the 60s, but not, you don't want to use it for text.
Not for setting type.
There's one other one I should say, Armchair Modern, which is a typeface by Stefan Hjertensen. I can't even pronounce his name because it's Icelandic and I'm Icelandic
we'll
illiterate. But he, that Armchair Modern from PsyOps, he also kind of went the same angle. He's like, I like this kind of these square forms that are kind of rounded, but it's really nice. So I would check that out.
Another question from Jeremy is, what are your favorite openings or closing title sequences for films, TV, etc.? And I'm going to go ahead and say you cannot say the movie Seven.
Okay.
Is this another stump question from him?
Yeah, that's the same guy. This guy's a film critic, so it makes sense he'd ask this question. I think that the one that made me start getting excited about film titles again was Catch Me If You Can.
That was a really nice one.
I don't remember the titles, but
yeah,
that was like, okay, people are trying to, they remembered in the, you know, 50s and 60s when titles were actually interesting and they were, you know, they're animated and they drew you into the story rather than just being, you know, a bunch of out of focus or close shots with you know, Garamond over the top. So that got me excited about titles again. I think ever since then, you know, you've seen a lot more that were more inventive and interesting.
You know, the one I liked that was recent, and I'm going to take a lot of heat for this because I have a feeling I'm probably one of the few people. I really liked the introduction as maybe as graphically cliche as it was of Quantum of Solace.
Oh, I haven't seen that, but I'm assuming it's just another James Bond one, or was it very creative?
It's a James Bond one, but I like the method that they did it in. Steven, did you see it?
Yeah, I've only read about it from Eve wrote about it on the font feed, so I just read about it. I haven't seen it yet, but it seemed like there were a lot of people that were enjoying it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes me feel a little better.
I really liked
the
cards that they had in between for each location.
Oh, I really love those title cards too. Yeah. Every location that they were at. This is kind of in reference to talking about the airport earlier, but yeah, in every different location that they had the type set up completely differently to reference that location, and it was one of the best ways I've seen it because you know most of those kinds of films it just they'll do the little techie London at the bottom of the screen popping up
typewriter film. They may not have all been historically accurate as some commenter said on the font feed, but they were obviously they gave you the flavor of the you know whatever location it was, and yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about with the airports. And it's like there's. You want to feel like when you've arrived somewhere that you're in a new place and you know get excited about where you are. One other title was Thank You for Smoking. I forgot that one. They did an amazing job with that.
Yeah.
Each you know carton of cigarettes was another you know another name in the titles, but they were designed to look exactly like smoking or like cigarette yeah. carton. So, and it was just beautifully done.
Here, I'll move on to another question we got, and this is from our friend John Bordley of I Love Typography, and he wants to know when will we see the next font book?
Oh. well, Eric Speakerman would kill me if I gave you some sort of date, because that would be impossible. But well, just to give you an example of what a task it is, the PDF, I have the PDF here on my hard drive of the last edition, and it is...
Well, we'll take that just as well.
Well, that's the thing. Let me tell you, I don't know how to get it to you, because it's 8 gigabytes.
Jeez. Wow.
That yeah, and this is just vectors. I mean, they're just, you know, it's just fonts. There's no raster information in there, but...
That's one of those where if you just put it on a hard drive and FedExed it, it would get there way faster than
yes, exactly.
over the internet.
We'll sell the new font drive instead of font book, and it'll just give you the book on a hard drive. No, so it's a huge undertaking. It's not something that you just put everything into a script and it outputs the samples. You have to go through each one, and we do these, Eve and I do these see also cross-references, so those are all done by hand, you know, just from what we know about fonts that are related. So it's a long, arduous process, and I couldn't even give you a date yet, but I can say that the current font book will, plus fontshop.com, will serve most of your needs.
Excellent. Great. Well, we look forward to it. There's a couple of other questions here. One of them, I just want to shout out some names real quick. We got questions that we won't be able to ask from Paul D. Hunt, SL Blaze, and Nerdsky. Paul's question actually was what the future of Typographica was, but we already covered that a little bit. Mm. So I think that covers our questions. Matt, is there anything else you want to talk about?
Oh, you know what? I will ask, are you ever going to get typograph.ca back?
No, I highly doubt that. The Canadians are—you don't get that—you don't get the idea that they're really aggressive people. But when it comes to the domain extension, man, yeah, they ripped that out from under us without even a warning. It was the strangest thing. And their claim was that we didn't have sufficiently Canadian content.
That seems strange, because you can own
sufficient
all these like
Canadian content.
You can own all these like .fm and .tv and .am that are all like the island of Tuvalu or something.
Right. But they're doing that on purpose. They're making, you know, some money doing that. But in Canada, they have, that's just one of the rules, that you need to be a Canadian company or some sort of Canadian entity in order to have it. We did it by the book. We registered it under one of our Canadian contributors, but I guess it wasn't enough for them.
Okay.
They caught on.
Yeah. But the funniest thing is that once it had changed, it was it had become one of those just search link spam sites. So the Canadian content was just like, you know, the easiest search for Viagra.
Hey, it's bringing money back into Canada, though. So,
yes.
And Matt, who was that question by?
That's an old schooler, whoever that was.
Rico. Yeah.
All right. Well, there's one other thing I wanted to reference to one of our earlier conversations about designers having just a handful of typefaces and kind of, you know, Matt and I are probably guilty of this. I know I always go back to my Garamond, Caslon, Helvetica, Scala, Sans, and those, you know, those kinds of faces. But I think
you could do
one,
worse than that.
I think Matt, and Matthew Carter, though, I feel like he really helped bring about this more modern age of professional typography. Because I just feel like so many of his faces are on that. That's when I think about these faces, I include Matthew Carter in the bunch. You know, a lot of the, Matt, would you agree with that?
Yeah, in that he is one of those go-to guys that you're never afraid to use a typeface by.
Yeah, and he really helped bring, you know, a contemporary feel to it. H&FJ, I think, is becoming very similar with, you know, Gotham and how widespread Gotham is becoming now.
Yeah, well, I think I think both of those guys are in a certain aesthetic, maybe more American
kind
aesthetic.
Of this, I feel like it's becoming, yeah, in America especially, but it's something that I think is going to become timeless in a sense.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, without a doubt, H&FJ do timeless stuff. Yeah. And it's interesting, if you ask people in Europe, then their answer would be, you know, Speakerman or you know,
oh,
the
yeah,
classic
of
line
of
typeface, you know,
well.
Frutiger.
Yeah, it's on the same line.
So it's kind of different depending on where you are, but it's true that there are some classics you cannot go wrong with, and what I never would say don't use those, but I do try to help people find alternatives if they're appropriate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's always about appropriateness.
And it's also just breaking the fear of, I kind of have this fear of using a bad face and being accused of it.
Right.
You know, you don't. It's breaking down that fear and trying to find the good typeface. Yeah. Well, sure.
If you trust a designer, I mean, for me, it's Christian Schwartz. I would use anything that he designed, like Amplitude. I've used more than any other typeface on personal stuff for the last few years, because mm-hmm. I know him, but I also know that his work, is so flawless that it's not going to hurt me if I use one of his faces. So, again, why I think it's important to get some serious typeface reviews published so that people can use some new stuff without fearing it.
Yeah, I think, and I'm excited to see that, because I think that'll be incredibly useful and hopefully break down some of those barriers designers have between their old fonts and hopefully their new fonts.
Oh, yeah. All right, well, I think that's all we have. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a great discussion.
Sure. Thank you. You guys are doing a fine job for claiming that you don't know what you're doing.
Well, thanks a lot.
All right, guys. Little announcement. Next week on the show, we're going to have Armin Vitt and Brioni Gomez Palacio from Under Consideration and Brand New. So if you have any questions, get those ready and go ahead and leave us a voicemail or email for them at
646-402-5686, extension 20248. Of course, you can always get us on Twitter at @RBTLShow.
And lastly, you can email us at readbetweentheleading@gmail.com. One other thing, in addition to questions for next week's episode, our call to action this week, ideas for type on the web. How can we balance protecting type foundries' intellectual property while still allowing for designers to easily be able to use faces on the web? Let us know what you think. And we always enjoy getting your questions, so definitely send some our way. Finally, the week after that, we're going to be recording segments for our student episode, so watch out for that. One other thing is, we didn't get the chance to ask Stephen on the show what his favorite typeface was, but we did talk about it a little bit after we were done recording, and it is FF Milo and FF Milo Serif. So check those out. All right, I think that's it. Once again, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Matt.
Thanks for listening.
Kid, you got moxie. I like it. I like it a lot.
All right. Matthew, you've got quite a lot of moxie. I'm quite proud of you. You got the moxie with you, Matthew.
Was that Sean Connery telling me that I have a lot of moxie?
You know, if it makes me sound more British, then fine.
We've told you before, he's not British. He's Scottish.
I've got to go.